Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week, we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week, we're dipping into our archives. We'll meet Berlin artist Patty Backer. We'll hear part two of Fishermen by Day, Bootleggers by Night, Prohibition Stories from Ocean City. We'll learn about Delmarva's Mighty Tomato. And Jim Rapp will give us some Delmarva water fun and safety tips. Patty Backer paints large-eyed creatures and fantastical scenes on wood, old furniture, and canvas. She describes her art as a mix of folk and lowbrow, sweet and sinister. She is part of a new generation of folk artists bringing a touch of whimsy to the art world.
I had a little shop uptown in Berlin, and I started painting furniture for my apartment. I had all this old, furniture, and I started painting it, and that's how it got started, and then it just started selling. I've always loved the sea. I'm afraid of the water, which is kind of funny, but it's my favorite place to be, at the beach or near the water. So I paint a lot of sea creatures, and I always have. I love bones and skulls and bugs, and I always have.
Like other local artists, Patty appreciates the benefits of the light, sand, and sea here on the shore, along with the convenience of living within easy driving distance of major urban art centers like D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York. But she especially appreciates the blossoming arts community in Berlin.
One thing I love is, you have the beautiful marsh and the seashore, but I love the, honky-tonk Ocean City downtown. I don't want to lose that. I get so sad because it seems like we're kind of homogenizing everything, and I hate that. I think there have always been a lot of artists here, but there are so many more places to show your work now. And also, the art that I really like, it used to be you never saw it here. And I remember Jay Frank at Pepper's Tavern used to have these really great art shows. And tattoo artists and just people who, did it part-time, full-time, but that you had no idea that they were making this really great art. And it was just so fun to be in a dive bar and with all your friends and just see all this great art for just one night. And of course, there are a lot more venues now for all of that, I think. And of course, it used to be, the big joke was it was all duck art. And it's not anymore, which is nice. And of course, it probably wasn't always, but.
One of Patty's favorite artists is the late Margaret Kilgallen, but she does not identify with any one influence on her work.
I don't draw as much as I'd like to. I generally just jump right into painting. And while I'll sometimes draw out the painting, I don't. I'll sketch an idea, funny quick sketches, but I don't actually. I used to keep a journal and draw every day, but I don't as much as I used to. And then I always do the little, my little scrap paintings on just little scraps of wood. And actually, that's kind of like my daily practice, I think. And one thing that I love is when people do look at my work and they come up with a story, especially kids, because, it just comes out. And I love that, And I definitely think that's one thing about my larger paintings that happens that I love. I love that, especially with the furniture, it's functional and they can live with it. A table in a room, it's like a little circus caravan. And I think it makes people happy. I've gotten lots of letters that say, I come down in the morning and I see your table and it makes me happy. And I mean, that's like the best thing ever. I get tears in my eyes. I think that, and that people live with it. That's such an honor. I do mermaids, but that's as close to the human figure as I normally do. And a woman came to me, this was in Las Vegas, and she wanted me to do a family portrait in my style. And it was really great. It turned out, I liked it. It was really fun. Strange, but fun.
Patty has an intuitive creative process. She produces both high quality and a high volume, but certain works seem to just magically turn out to be special.
It's so funny how that happens. And then there'll be other paintings that are just, I don't know what it is that, you know, all of a sudden I'll think, oh, it's done. And of course, a lot of it, because it's so illustrative, I'll have a definite idea of what it's gonna look like, but it never, you know, it always changes mid painting. But that's such a good feeling. And then other times I will have been working on it, you know, I keep coming back to it, and my husband will come in and say, oh, that's incredible. And then I think, oh, well, maybe, okay. Maybe it's done then, I don't know. But, you know, there are always those paintings where you think, I really don't like this very much. Maybe I'll paint over it. And, you know, he would be so upset if I painted over it, so.
Once, a collector who happened to be on the board of the High Museum in Atlanta asked if he could purchase an entire show of her work. She agreed as long as she could deliver the work personally and see his private collection, which she said was spectacular. Patty advises artists who are just starting out to learn to be true to themselves.
If somebody says, your art is weird, which I've heard, don't listen to them. You know, I mean, if it makes you happy, if you're doing it and it's making you happy and you're feeling like you're getting something out that you need to get out, keep doing it.
Patty accepts commissions and shows her work at Bungalow Love and Baked, both in Berlin, and Dimensions and OC Wasabi, both in Ocean City. Get a link to Patty's website on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. Art strolls are definitely a habit worth forming. Every month, enjoy a great night out while supporting local artists and businesses. Galleries and shops stay open late. Opening receptions feature special gallery exhibits. Often there is free entertainment. Many of Delmarva's communities now have monthly art strolls. Visit our website so you can get in the art stroll habit. delmarvaalmanac.com/artstrolls. George Hurley and his wife Suzanne wrote a number of books about Ocean City's storied past and were dedicated historians who were instrumental in the development of the Ocean City Lifesaving Station Museum. In the last year, we lost both of these community treasures. In honor of them, we're airing this story we did several years ago about bootlegging. Last week, we did part one. I talked with George at his home. Suzanne was there, too. She didn't want to be recorded, but from time to time she would stop us and correct George on a detail or two. Here is the conclusion of Fishermen by Day, Bootleggers by Night, Prohibition Stories from Ocean City. Here is George Hurley.
I think it was a hard game. I mean, to go offshore at night in the dark and navigate and know exactly how to meet the mothership. Heavy work loading the whiskey, bringing it in through the waves. And I think they would have had to have been very brawny men. I think they probably used the pound boats that were used during the day for fishing, which were essentially double-ended boats with bows at each end almost, and or in very narrow stern, so that the waves could go around them. But I think the main suppliers would have been steamships, and they probably never came closer than 5 or 6 miles offshore.
During Prohibition, whiskey was shipped from Canada to points up and down the East Coast, and rum came from the opposite direction in the Caribbean. The government outfitted retired World War I naval vessels to serve as the rum runners patrol, looking for contraband and bootleggers. George had this to say about the corruption that developed in response to Prohibition.
Ellen Weaver, whose family owns the beer business at the foot of the bridge, Baltimore Avenue and North Division Street, told me this story. She told me how many of the very important and respected local men were caught, arrested, and jailed. And each day, Ocean City's police force would march them in double file, about 20 of them, to the Del Mar Hotel and serve them. Mrs. Savannah Carey would serve them breakfast. And then they'd be marched back to jail. And that afternoon, they'd be marched back to the Del Mar to eat again, and then back to the jail. And they were always, she said, when everyone laughed about it, because they joked and laughed, and it was all one big joke. But they had to serve 30 days for having been caught with contraband. I don't know much about Delaware, but I do know in Virginia, with all those lonely barrier islands, when we built homes down there, old-timers would tell me of the keepers of Coast Guard stations and how they had the only Cadillac on the island. And it was obvious they just looked the other way to allow whiskey to come ashore in their district. So I am sure as you went north and the population increased, there was probably less of that, but it still went on to some extent, I'm sure. Now, the Lucky Lindy was the original. That goes way back, sometime in the 20s. Probably about the time Lindbergh flew to Paris. But there was one around 49th Street called the Brass Rail, which the Shaw family, or Gordy family, owned, same thing. There was another one called the Sandbar at 33rd Street that was run by a man named Sammy Adams, and it had quite a reputation. There was another one at 17th Street where the CVS is today called Rick's Raft. All of these places were out of town. The sheriff or any law enforcement before the days of helicopters would have to come through downtown to raid them. And they knew it. And they had spotters that would warn them. And there were slot machines, I'm sure, later in illegal liquor. Possibly prostitution. Anything went in those days. The original George Washington was supposedly built with Al Capone's money. I don't think he was involved in the hotel, but I think he provided money for it. And I've only been told that by elderly people like these people, but I have no proof of that. And I'm sure it was more than just tea and crumpets. Some of the names that Mrs. Lynch and Charles Elliott have dropped to me over the years are very wealthy families today. Now, whether the wealth came from liquor or whether that was a little boost in the beginning, I can't say. But I'm sure Mrs. Lynch, for example, used to laugh about it. But I'm sure as people become more esteemed in the community, they like to talk about it less. You got to remember there was a depression going on too, and they were providers, some of them were good providers.
Prohibition only lasted from 1920 until 1933. In the opposite order that the Delmarva states ratified the 18th Amendment, they ratified its repeal. Delaware was the first on Delmarva and the sixth in the nation, with Maryland and Virginia following at 28 and 29. It's interesting to note that the last two did so only after the Great Atlantic Hurricane of August 1933. That storm is famous for creating a new inlet in Ocean City while destroying train access to the barrier island and the infrastructure that supported the fishing village at the south end of town. With Prohibition's repeal, change, and ironically, a new prosperity swept over the town like the waves of that storm. The commercial fishing industry blossomed. And with the return of alcohol sales, so did the hospitality and tourism business. Today, in Worcester County alone, there are over 250 stores, restaurants, and bars that sell alcohol. Most of these are on that thin 10-mile strip of land called Ocean City. Even though the town is known as a family resort, drinking is a big part of the beach town's lifestyle. And there's still a black market in marijuana and other illegal activities, though drug dealers are perhaps not held in the same regard as bootleggers. George said that the beach area has long attracted big talkers and wheeler dealers. It's also attracted tough survivors who have not been afraid to work hard in a challenging place. It's no wonder that we tend to admire those rascal pirate bootleggers of long ago. After all, the law is no match for those who dare to make their living at the mercy of the wind and the mighty surf. Check out the video documentary of this story online, where you can see archived photos and film provided by the Ocean City Life Saving Station Museum. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On June 22, 1937, the workers of the Phillips Packing Company in Cambridge, Maryland, went on strike for higher wages, an 8-hour day, and the right to form a union. And on June 24, 1944, 1,000 German prisoners of war, captured in Africa during World War II, were delivered by train to the detention center Camp Somerset in Westover, Maryland. POWs were contracted out to local farmers, canners, and lumber operations for 8 cents a day. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll learn about Delmarva's mighty tomato. And Jim Rapp will give us some Delmarva summer water fun and safety tips. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. When you think of quintessential Delmarva crops, corn and soybeans often come to mind. Certainly strawberries, peaches, and even pumpkins are what we see along our roadsides throughout the growing season. But the mighty tomato has had as great an impact on the diet, culture, and economy of Delmarva as any other crop. It seems funny to refer to the tomato as a berry, but that is essentially what it is, a very big berry. The tomato vine is a member of the nightshade family. It is technically a fruit, but it is used as a vegetable. Believe it or not, the venerated U.S. Supreme Court has actually weighed in on that distinction. In the late 19th century, the state of New York had an import tax on vegetables, but not fruit. When they tried to impose taxes on tomatoes, importers responded by taking them to court. The case went all the way to the top, with the Supreme Court unanimously deciding that because of its common usage as a vegetable, it should be taxed as one. There are several varieties of tomatoes available year-round in our markets, but fresh, locally grown tomatoes found at your nearby roadside stand from June through September are simply the best. Though the big, deep red beefsteak tomato probably remains the champion, in recent years, heirloom tomato varieties have become very popular. They come in just about every color of the rainbow except blue. These are touted for their intensity of flavor and nutrition. Scientists are divided about whether heirloom seeds, saved and passed down from year to year and generation to generation, are as desirable as those that come from more currently hybridized plants. This is the heart of the debate about all genetically manufactured crops, which is essentially what all hybrid plants are in some form or fashion. For the average gardener, the question is answered by their own experience. Tomatoes that get the proper amount of sun and water and which are grown in really good soil taste the best no matter what variety they are. The attentive gardener can have as productive vines planting them in the ground as they do when planted in containers. Beginning gardeners often have their first success growing the versatile tomato. The tomato's history as a plant cultivated for human consumption has its beginnings in Peru, where archaeologists have found evidence of its use as far back as 500 BC. Over time, the tomato was grown and eaten throughout southern and central America. When Europeans invaded Mexico, tomato seeds were among the plunder which they brought back home with them. After some initial fears about tomatoes being poisonous, the tomato became a culinary sensation. Some called them love apples. Tomato seeds came back to the Americas again with a colonist who grew tomatoes in their gardens. By the mid-1850s, canning plants dotted the peninsula for the commercial preservation and transport of seafood and a variety of fruits and vegetables. Things really took off when cheap tin cans became widely available from manufacturing plants in Baltimore. In the early 20th century, there were probably more than 100 canneries here with a large concentration in Wicomico County. Cambridge once promoted itself as the tomato canning capital of the world. In 1912, even Ocean City had a cannery with tomatoes being delivered by barge for processing. The owners of these canning operations made great fortunes and rose in the ranks of society and politics locally and beyond. In the beginning, the workers in those plants were poor whites and African-American slave descendants. As immigration increased, Italians and Slavic workers drifted out of the big cities to find work and less crowded living conditions here on the Eastern Shore. At the height of Delmarva's canning industry, there were as many as 15,000 cannery workers. Some made as much as $5 a day, which for the time was a decent wage. This all began to decline in the 1950s, with competition from other warm weather states who had longer growing seasons. Labor conflicts and advances in refrigerated shipping brought about a consolidation of canning. Delmarva's smaller local operations were squeezed out of business. Now most of the canned tomato products we use come from California, Italy, and beyond. Tomatoes are still a cash crop here on Delmarva, but not many farmers want to take them on. Though there are some mechanical solutions available, picking tomatoes for the most part still requires human hands because of their delicate nature. Immigrant laborers who do this work come mostly from Latin America. It's interesting that the cuisine they've brought with them really brings the tomato full circle. Variations on their traditional dishes like salsa are as commonplace in restaurants as pizza or ketchup on hamburgers and french fries. Tomatoes are in fact found in cuisines all around the world. One of the reasons that tomatoes are so widely loved is that for every fancy dish you can make with them, there is one that requires no particular skill at all. And really, there is nothing like that first fresh, ripe tomato of the summer. I've known some people who will eat them like an apple. No slicing or dicing, just a great big bite out of the middle, letting the juice run down their chin. My favorite summer tomato recipe is simply to take corn cut from the cob after it has been blanched and cooled and mix it with diced tomatoes and minced shallots. A splash of olive oil and ordinary vinegar with a little salt and pepper is the perfect summer salad. If you like things spicy, add your favorite minced pepper and a few sprigs of cilantro. The mighty tomato continues to prevail as an important part of our diet, so every summer it is celebrated in Vienna, Maryland at the Great Eastern Shore Tomato Festival. Visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/living, for a link to more information about this festival and links to locally produced food sources. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to give us some summer water fun and safety tips.
If you want endless opportunities for summer fun on the water, then Delmarva is the place to be. If you move from the safety of the shore to float on it or swim in it, you must respect the water and be aware of its dangers. If you can't swim or are unprepared or uninformed, water can be dangerous. When folks think about dangers in the ocean, they often dwell on the toothy creatures that prowl behind the waves in search of prey. Yes, we have sharks swimming off the Delmarva coast. The risk of being attacked, however, is statistically very slim. You are much more likely to be struck by lightning or be injured in your own home than attacked by a shark. Other marine animals do pose a risk when swimming in the ocean and bay, but they rarely cause serious injury. One of the more common human-animal conflicts involves sea nettles, known to most as jellyfish. These milky white relatives of corals and anemones thrive when Delmarva's coastal waters are warm and salty, which coincides with our busy summer beach season. Sea nettle tentacles can grow up to 6 feet long, and they contain thousands of microscopic barbed stingers that inject venom into their prey or predator or an unsuspecting human swimmer. Each stinger has a tiny bulb that contains venom, which is released through a coiled, needle-shaped tube. Sea nettle stings result in immediate burning pain and can leave reddish-brown, whip-like streaks on the skin. The pain will usually peak in the first 5 minutes after contact and will lessen over the next several hours. Rinsing with salt water can treat most sea nettle stings. Do not use fresh water to rinse a sting. Fresh water dilutes the salts outside of the stinger, which can cause more venom to be released. If you get home and the sting persists, apply vinegar or a baking soda paste and take a pain reliever. Someone having a severe reaction to a sting may require emergency care. Another animal that may cause a mild fright while exploring Delmarva's fresh and brackish water rivers and bays is the water snake. Like most of our sharks, our water snakes are inappropriately labeled as dangerous risk to human safety. We have two species of aquatic snake on Delmarva, and both are non-venomous. The northern water snake is our most common species. It can grow up to 4 feet long and often has wide, dark bands separated by lighter colored bands that can range from tan to orange-red. Older snakes are darker and often lack a clear pattern. The less common red-bellied water snake can grow to 5 feet long and can have a chocolate to black back and a bright reddish-orange belly. The most common life-threatening dangers in our waters are not animals, but powerful currents known as riptides. These channeled currents of water flow away from the shore and typically rip through the surf zone along our beaches past the breaking waves. Riptide speeds are typically 1 to 2 feet per second, but speeds as high as 8 feet per second have been measured. This is faster than an Olympic swimmer. To avoid riptides, never swim alone and only swim at beaches with lifeguards. If caught in a rip current, remain calm. Panic will waste your energy and cause you to not think clearly. Don't fight the current. If you're able, swim out of the current in a direction parallel to the shoreline. If you are unable to swim out of the riptide, float or calmly tread water. When the current ends, swim towards shore. If you become tired and unable to swim back, draw attention to yourself by facing the shore, waving your arms, and yelling for help. After heavy summer rainstorms, another silent, invisible danger may appear in Delmarva's coastal water. During heavy rainfall, bacteria can be found in the runoff that flows into our bays and rivers. Many factors contribute to high bacteria levels, including animal manure applied to Delmarva farm fields, failing septic systems, and sewer leaks. Bacteria can thrive in these warm, nutrient-enriched waters, and they may cause minor illness for a healthy adult or more serious infections for people with impaired immune systems. Local health departments and Delmarva waterkeepers test the water for high bacteria levels often between Memorial Day and Labor Day. We've provided links to this information on the Delmarva Almanac website. To protect yourself from infection, do not swim in our bays and rivers after a heavy rainstorm, and pay attention to posted beach closings. If you make contact with water that may contain high bacteria levels, wash off with warm soapy water as soon as possible. If you learn just a little about the real risks of water safety, there is no end to the fun you can have this summer in the Atlantic Ocean and Delmarva's bays and rivers.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore, and underwriters eatdrinkbuyart.com for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.